This is the RDU on Stage podcast. I'm Lauren Van Hamert, your host, and on this episode, I'm chatting with Jennifer Natalia Fink. Jennifer Natalia Fink is the author of five novels, including the doctoral prize-winning book Bopple Dance. She also penned the play Bitter Flower, one of the short plays being presented by Burning Coal Theater and the Gilbert Theater as part of the 19th Amendment Project. Fink's writing style has been described as ecstatic, cutting, and fiercely intelligent, words that might also describe African-American activist Ida B. Wells Barnett. Wells Barnett used her platform and skills as a writer and activist to shed light on lynching, for which she was awarded a Pulitzer Prize posthumously earlier this year. Wells Barnett openly confronted white women in the suffrage movement, like Jane Addams, about racism and social injustice, which is the subject of Fink's play. Fink says the fault lines between black and white feminists are ever present, and that is where our conversation begins.
The white suffrage movement was a racist movement. There's just no contesting that. The leaders of the white suffrage movement really made a bargain with the existing power structure to gain votes for white women at the expense of votes for black men and women. That's the historical reality, and it's been buried. So part of my work is sort of exposing this racist underbelly and making it clear to readers and audiences that the racism is a feature, not a bug, because I think that's the history that I was told, that, oh, you know, these white women, of course, in some ways just reflected the racism of their time, but that's sort of a sidebar. And there was sort of this kumbaya moment in the teens and up to the 19th Amendment being passed where black women and white women came together. That's not really true. It was a segregationist movement. And my play really explores some of the dynamics between the leaders of the black and white suffrage movements.
Now, this work, Bitter Flower, grew out of another piece you did called Underbelly, which it looks like you performed that in February. And in that piece, you organized a march up Michigan Avenue in Chicago. So can you talk to me about that experience?
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. Part of what my collaborator, Julie Lafine, and I were interested in were how suffragists occupied public space. It was kind of a new thing for women to march in the streets. And they did so in part because one of the arguments against women's suffrage was, oh, the poor dears can't go outside the home to the polling place, which just sounds so absurd to us now. What will their children do? Their husbands won't get dinner on time. This was seriously part of the argument. But the idea of women in public space was really a radical concept. So suffragists marched in part to get the public comfortable with this idea. So we reconstructed that. And Illinois was really a pivotal state for the suffrage movement. And what we did was we researched 50 leading suffragists, 30 African-American and 20 white, and had a little handout on each one written in the first person. Hi, my name is Ida B. Wells Barnett, and here's what I did. And in the case of the white women, 201, we found that there was a racist underbelly to their story. We didn't have to push it. They just, all of them were also engaged in racist activities as well as suffrage activities. So on one side, we made suffrage sashes, which on one side had the names of the suffragists embroidered, both the African-American and the white women. And on the flip side, on the African-American women's, we put their sort of unheralded work as civil rights workers, artists, and suffragists. And on the white women's, we sort of exposed the underbelly. We sort of wrote the name of their sins on the back. We wrote what they had done besides suffrage that was racist. And we got 50 women together. We marched wearing the sashes, wearing modern clothes. I wore a white puffy coat, and I started out with all 50 of the banners on me, handed them out. We marched through the streets, and when we came back to the gallery, we installed the sashes with some explanation and invited viewers of the gallery to actually touch the sashes. And, you know, one of the unexpected things about it was, you know, we talked, the women and I, as we marched, is almost all of us had participated in the women's marches of 2016, right? And it evoked that, and it made us think about sort of what had changed and what hadn't in the way race was intersecting with how we thought about and marched about women's rights. So that was a really unanticipated conversation. The other thing that I didn't anticipate was this fascinating history of the relationship between Jane Addams and Ida B. Wells Barnett, both of whom I knew about, but I didn't know that they were not only in Chicago at the same time, but were both involved in the suffrage movement pivotally, and that they had a very fraught relationship. And that really becomes the centerpiece of Bitter Flower, that the dynamics between them.
Well, I love that you brought that up. So I want to talk about these two women for a second. When you're writing a play around historical events and you're writing characters who were in fact real people like these two women, how important is it for you to be very factual in the storytelling, and how much artistic license can you take?
Oh, that's a great question. I love it. I don't think there's a formula, but any truth claim that's made, any factual event that's referred to, any historical event that's referred to in my play is documented, right? The fact that they met is documented, but this is kind of a, you know, who was in the room, right? I'm imagining myself to be in the room of that conversation between them. There's not a record of what they actually said, so I make it up. But I did read both, not only scholarly works about them, but also their own autobiographies. I found the most interesting for capturing their voices, their own point of view about their own work. They're very different. Syntax and diction and personalities really came through in the autobiographies. So I think that was really important to sort of capturing the flavor of each of them and their very different personalities. So that's one set of stuff that I was dealing with. They both published letters in response to each other. And I actually used the letters, the exact letters, about the subject of lynching, which is much more connected to suffrage than you'd imagine. So I do use the actual text of those letters, edited for clarity and brevity, but I don't change their syntax or diction. So that those pieces are just lifted from history. But the dialogue, I didn't want to make up any events, but their relationship, I kind of had to extrapolate and explore. I was interested in what each had said about the other. And Ida B. Wells mentions Jane Addams a few times in her autobiography and simply says, "Jane Addams was the most famous woman in the world. I needed her help." Susan B. Anthony said that Ida B. Wells seemed conflicted between her role as a suffrage leader and being a parent, and that she always seemed so tired. So I looked at some of the accounts by the white feminists of Ida B. Wells, who seemed very threatened by her being both a mother of six and a leader. And Jane Addams didn't say much about her at all. So that was interesting to me as well.
Much of your work centers around historic events. So what influence do history plays like Bitter Flower or historic literature like your last book have on our collective consciousness. Can these works affect or change how we view history or even the current state of the world today?
I absolutely think so. We're going to keep repeating this false consciousness and false history between white feminists and black feminists or womanists if we don't understand its origins. That's what I think. That's why we really need to understand how deeply rooted, how fundamental in structuring the racism was to the feminist movement, to the suffrage movement and the feminist movement that came out of it. We can't really grapple until we have an honest conversation about that. And we can't have an honest conversation about that if we don't understand the facts. That's sort of the simple reason I wrote this play. At the same time, I think so often white women portray black women or black women only enter white women's consciousness as victims, you know? And Ida B. Wells Barnett, honey, she was nobody's victim. Trust me. She was victimized, but she was such a badass. And not only was she just this incredibly strong person, she really knew how to work with and against the white racist white feminist movement and hold it accountable and transform it. So I wanted to also recuperate that history. I knew about Ida B. Wells Barnett as creator of the Black Women's Club movement and as a civil rights leader who did foundational work against lynching. But I did not know about her role in the suffrage movement, which was absolutely pivotal, absolutely pivotal. And the way she sold suffrage to the Black community was this basically doubles the Black vote. This is how we get Black men elected, because feminism and suffrage were seen as sort of a rich white women's preoccupation. How would this help Black people? She sold it. She really did. So I wanted to recuperate that history as well. Basically, Jane Addams makes this claim that lynching is bad not because it's unjust. She assumes the crime that lynching is supposed to address, which was the rape of white women by black men, actually was a thing. And it's just an incommensurate punishment, is her argument. Ida B. Wells Barnett gets the police records of every lynching that has occurred in the past 2 years in America. The police reports. She gets those. She reviews them, makes a statistical study entirely independently of her own, and says, look, that's not what happened. Basically, black men and women are being punished for the crime of trying to be citizens, trying to own property, trying to have jobs that white people don't want them to have. These are not actually sexual crimes against white women. That's a myth. She proves it. And that just struck me as so incredible to, first of all, believe that the facts will set us free, that this is what would be convincing, and to go and do that work. And that's just amazing to me. She also invented the term African-American, understanding Black people as part of the hyphenated culture that we all are a part of in America was pivotal. I thought it was Jesse Jackson. Nope, Ida B. Wells Barnett. She also is the first person to hyphenate her name, understanding that for women to have power and authority, they cannot lose their identities upon marriage. And for the time, she had a very equalitarian marriage. I did not know that. I thought it was like Gloria Steinem or somebody. She was so far ahead of her time. She was such a visionary. So I just got excited about sharing who she was and what she did. And also sort of the complicated person Jane Addams was. She's the first woman to win the Nobel Prize. She starts social work as we know it. She brings the settlement house movement to the U.S. She was a lesbian. She lived openly with her partner at Hull House. She carried a life-sized oil painting of her lover wherever she went. It was like such a hilarious image. And she understood how to work the system. She was from a very elite background, and she understood how to negotiate power with the powerful men of Chicago, the U.S., the president, the world. I Ida B. Wells Barnett was a much straighter talker. She didn't have that access to power, but she still got so much done. Everybody liked Jane Addams. Everybody talks about her as sort of sweet and genteel. Everybody with power seemed to find Ida B. Wells Barnett kind of a tough broad. You can tell which one I identified with. So I wanted to bring these two incredible people to life and to not whitewash, bury, or, you know, sort of obfuscate the centrality of racism for the suffrage movement. And that just because there were Black and white women involved does not mean it was an integrationist movement. It was not.
When you look at the intersection of the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement then, and the women's rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement now, have we made progress or does it feel like we're going backwards?
Both, you know, yes and no, both. So I cannot imagine a white feminist, even the most naive mainstream, you know, lean in kind of corporate feminists, justifying lynching in 2020. Let's just say that the way Jane Addams, who was considered one of the most progressive women in the world, did, right? So that's no longer associated with feminism. However, Rand Paul tried to block an anti-lynching measure in Congress. And just that in 2020, we're still having debates about lynching is shocking and appalling to me, right? This should not be a thing. This should not be a debate. So, you know, I think the underbelly, the deeply racist underbelly of American culture has been exposed. It's misogyny. But I think the feminist movement, I think, wants to be on the right side of history, wants to be truly integrationist, wants to truly be, you know, on the side of, allied with Black Lives Matter. But you cannot do so. We cannot do so until we face the truth about the origins of white feminism, is my feeling. And that's why I wrote this play. So I think that needs to be better integrated and understood. I think white women still really need to do that work. However, I am so inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement and the amazing women who are at the head of it. You know, they are really the great-grandchildren of Ida B. Wells Barnett, you know? That's the legacy. So I'm both awed and inspired, and I still think we have a lot of work to do, not just on the right. Like, we can see on the right, the Trumpy people, but also on the left, also in the feminist movement.
Is there an immediacy to Bitter Flower that you feel as a writer to get this out now?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think really thinking intersectionally, you know, people like these buzzwords, right? But if we're really going to think race and gender together, we have to come to terms with this history and make new meaning of it. And just like, you know, I was a big fan of Obama's, I still am, but you know, there was this moment where everyone thought if Obama's elected, then we're like post-racial, right? And now we kind of laugh at that. That seems incredibly naive. I will be elated for a Black woman to be my vice president, right? But that will not undo this legacy. It does not undo it. We have to undo it. That's on us to undo it.
And don't you feel a little bit, and maybe this is why I feel so passionate about the 19th Amendment Project and this work of plays. I also feel that we have to reconcile our own racism, our own racist views as white women, so that we can, as a country, resolve that we're going to have a Black vice president, a Black female vice president.
Absolutely. I know. And I feel excited when I just even hear those words, a Black woman vice president. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I'm a white Jewish woman, right? I was raised by white Jewish liberal parents. And, you know, racism was bad. And it was certainly something, you know, not to really examine in yourself. And to understand that we're all sort of implicated in this history that might just be like, oh, we don't notice that there are no Black kids in our kids' school, or, you know what I mean? Like, there are all these passive forms of segregation and racism, and nothing gets you out of it. And the point isn't to get out, but to rather go deeper in to work it through. And I do think there is a reckoning going on that where maybe for the first time, white women are really embracing that challenge rather than explaining all the ways that they're not racist, right? And, you know, I certainly have been guilty of that myself. I don't put myself outside that. You know, my partner, I'm queer, my partner is Asian American, my kid is biracial, blah, blah, blah. You know, I could give you all this evidence of my progressive ideas, right? But I live in a racist society. I've benefited from racism. I, you know, live in a very segregated world. And I think the notion that we really have to work to be anti-racist, it's not just enough to not be racist, being anti-racist is a different set of stuff. And I saw myself in Jane Addams in certain ways, right? This queer kind of trailblazing, you know, woman who knew how to deal with power and was sort of looking to play both sides. I think, you know, she felt a lot of pressure from white Southern women who were basically Confederate wives, who were financially supporting the white feminist and suffrage movement, right? And, you know, she acceded to them in some ways. So don't be Jane Addams, right? But I think implicating oneself is really the work that we all have to do, not in a narcissistic and self-flagellating way, but in a coming to terms with how we're a part of this history. We're not outside it.
And I think it's coming to terms with this notion of white privilege, which I know is a big buzzword now, but it's something that I think white people overall are having trouble. Some white people are struggling with. I wonder though, and this is so interesting to me, so I also am a Jewish white woman. So I kind of feel
there are a lot of this us in this movement, right?
Yeah. And that's kind of where I'm going. Don't you kind of feel that as Jewish white women, because we have a little bit of that heritage of oppression, that we embrace this anti-racist work a little bit easier?
I think it's a double-edged thing, honestly, that legacy. It's a complicated and double-edged thing, and it's been important to me to listen to a lot of Black Jewish women and sort of their experiences of racism in the Jewish world as well, because we are, you know, acculturated to both, you know, thinking about universalizing our own oppression and thinking about anti-Semitism as a form of racism, right? And sort of identifying with the other, identifying with the oppressed. And parts of our spiritual tradition tell us to do that. You know, that's part of our religion, actually, not just culture. But at the same time, that's an you can easily ally differences that way, right? And there was a part of me that, because, you know, my great-grandparents and grandparents are all immigrants, I kind of felt like we weren't even here in 1901. Like, nobody in my family was even in this country at that point. This isn't my legacy. This isn't my, you know, these are these like horrible WASPs, right? Jane Addams, you know, my great-grandparents in 1901 were like illiterate peasants in the Pale of Settlement, right? You know, as an American, I am part of this, and I have benefited. You know, there's a lot of work on how Jews became viewed as white people, like a particular kind of white people, but white people. So I think it's important to sort of push back against some of the easy places we end up. And at the same time, I think it's great that, you know, that's part of our tradition. I'm proud of that tradition. And I don't feel like anything my parents raised me with in regard to this was wrong. It's just not enough. it's just not enough. And they sort of, there's sort of a stopping at the safe place rather than looking deeper and saying, but if I send my kid to a Jewish day school, how many kids of color are going to be in that school, right? And thinking about sort of these passive forms of racism and this feminist tradition where Jews appear in it and disappear and how that's implicated in this really segregated history and really racist history.
Absolutely. Taking race out of it and just looking at gender, do you think COVID has helped or hurt the women and the women's movement?
I don't think we ever really can take race out of it. I think it's always intersectional. But I do think, that said, thinking about Ida B. Wells Barnett having six, count them six, children. I have one and I can hardly, you know, get through the day. What she was able to do and how sort of punished she was actually for doing it. She couldn't win. She was sort of called a bad mother, not just by men, but by Susan B. Anthony. It's like, Susan B. Anthony, you're calling Ida B. Wells Barnett a bad mother. Susan B. Anthony said something that I hear all the time from women. Well, don't have children if you don't want to dedicate every single second of your life to them. You know, that rhetoric is still around. In terms of COVID, I think it's exposed how much extra work all women are doing all the time, the sort of the double shift we all do. You have children, I have children. All of us who have children who are women are doing some sort of double shift, right? We're working outside the home and doing all the work inside the home 9 times out of 10. And for women in poverty, single women, who have children, who are more likely to be women of color and BIPOC women, that's only intensified, right? So I think the effects are still uneven amongst different women, but I think it has exposed how dysfunctional that is now that the workplace is in the home, how unfair and dysfunctional that is, I think, is being exposed. So that's where I think things are at in this country. I do think the impact is very different based on race and class.
Another population that we don't talk enough about, particularly when it comes to racism and even COVID, is our disabled community. And I know you do a lot of advocacy work. So can you talk about disability culture and how that fits into this whole conversation of equality and inclusivity?
Absolutely. And it all comes back to Ida B. Wells Barnett, like everything does. Her parents died when she was 16, leaving her with siblings to take care of, one of whom probably had cerebral palsy and was disabled. So she immediately assumed this adult role. It was assumed that she'd sort of like throw away the child with the disability, and she didn't. So it was amazing to find this disability story, and I wasn't looking for it. And there it was, because it's everywhere. It's part of everyone's life, actually. Everyone's family has disability. It's the largest minority group in the world. 20% of the population is disabled. And if you live long enough, you too will be disabled, because that's how life works. So I think care is like the missing piece that connects all these issues, in that care is undervalued. We live in denial that we'll ever need it, and it's feminized, so it's undervalued in our culture. And COVID is really exposing that, both in things like who gets to be on a ventilator, whose life is valuable, what happens when care workers can't come in, the rampant explosion of COVID in group homes and nursing homes. So the relationship between care and power and our values is really exposed, I think, with COVID. Hopefully, as with sort of the impossible situation of working women, this leads to real policy changes and not just yet another think piece about it, right? And same with my play. I really hope that Bitter Flower helps all women reclaim this amazing history of Black feminism and womanism, and also really grapple with and change and challenge the narrative about suffrage that they've received. So it's not enough just to sort of write something, a cute little think piece or whatever. It has to really change and challenge something.
Yes. If these two women, Ida B. Wells and Jane Addams, were around now, having done this research with them and lived with these characters a bit, what do you think they would say about the Black Lives Matter movement and this fourth wave of feminism?
I think Ida B. Wells Barnett would love it. And Jane Addams, you know, I don't know what she'd make of it. She was one of those people who kind of plays both sides of things. She was very pragmatic. So I think she might be more critical and less radical. At the same time, Ida B. Wells Barnett was really held captive by respectability politics. She was very concerned with like running a beautiful house and keeping up appearances because she knew what the costs would be for her as a public figure if she didn't. But I think she is, you know, the mother of the Black Lives Matter movement in a way. That was sort of, that simple truth was at the center of everything she did.
I love that. Now you've made me want to read more about her. And, you know, I'm a little obsessed with her because she was also, you know, she was a journalist like me. Now I want to dig in deep and dive in and find out more. So
while she was writing her autobiography, and the word she was writing when she passed was going. I love that. We should all pass that way. But she was always, you know, she was someone who did not accept the status quo and was able to see so beyond where the conversations were. Some of the sort of more bougie Black women in the Black women's club movement did not like her. The doctors and lawyers' wives who wanted to just be, to sort of mimic white middle class respectability and be housewives, they did not like her. They would like not invite her to things, you know, oy, the pettiness, you wouldn't believe it, because she wanted more than that. She wanted she had a bigger vision. She didn't just want to be equal to a housewife. She wanted to be able to really change and challenge things.
So what's next for you? Are you working on another book? Are you working on another play?
Actually working on a bunch of things, but I'm turning Bitter Flower into a screenplay that's sort of a bigger story about the 19th Amendment and the story of Illinois in particular. And Ida B. Wells and Jane Addams, and connecting it to the present moment a little more. So it's a longer span of time and the bigger cast of characters. So that's what's happening next for Bitter Flower. I think another theater has actually been interested in it because it does feel so timely to people. It does kind of speak to this moment. So that's exciting. And then, yes, I'm working on a novel and a performance piece with Julie Lafine as well. So I have a bunch of projects, but I am hoping, Hollywood, if you're out there, to complete a draft of a screenplay of extended version, a full-length version of Bitter Flower.
Bitter Flower is available to view virtually through the end of September. I'll put a link in the episode notes. If you like what you've heard today, please consider subscribing to the podcast, become a patron of the show, follow us on social media at RDU on Stage, or visit us online at www.rduonstage.com. Until next time, I'll see you at the theater.